Right. You are now being recorded.
Okay.
What's that? Three and this is three.
No, they won't.
Okay, let's see.
Can see up and running.
Rachel may call in, that's why I have the speakerphone.
Okay. So just as a warning, you're now being recorded, and the tape will be scrutinized by the Department of Homeland Security. Vitaly has some questions about last week that might be of interest to all of you. For one thing, he discovered that from KEC, you don't have some of the nice keywords like biosec that I described, and that's true of any data that comes from a Caltech instrument, just a general rule. And one other very subtle thing, I didn't actually discuss the normalization of those flat fields. So when you take the flat field, what you want to do is make it so that the average correction that you're applying is 1, you know, with some variation around it. So you want to take some statistics of this sky flat or dome flat or whatever that you built up, and then divide out by that statistic. Now you have to make sure you're very consistent. So for instance, if I had a flat from night 1 and a flat from night 2, and I only have standards on night 2, I really have to be careful if I want to apply them to night 1 that I've got that relative normalization correct, or I will introduce a scale error in the fluxes. So there's some subtle things like that. And usually it's not difficult, but sometimes you know, if there are, say, bad columns or something like that in the CCD, you want to use nice robust statistics, so whatever that value you're dividing by is very reproducible. All right, so today we're going to move on in this series to discuss aperture photometry, and I'll discuss, first of all, just isolated point source aperture photometry, the simple stuff, and then we'll describe some other things you have to do to account for supernova, and some things are more difficult, but some things become a bit easier as well. So let's go through these. All right, so this was actually a star that we had for one of our other images. I'm just going to use it as an example. So this was a KEC ESI image of some random source. And basically, I just want to go through here to set down the definition so that you know all the definitions for doing aperture photometry. And I'm going to start with an isolated point source. This is isolated by astronomical standards. You can't obviously get rid of everything in the field. But nothing immediately merged with this. So basically, your source has got some flux, and you have to define a position for it. And defining positions is not a particularly controversial thing. Lots of different algorithms for doing that. All right, and then you're going to have some sort of measurement aperture defined by the radius. And in all cases I've ever seen, it's centered on the source. I can't see any reason why it would not be. And you have to select that radius, and that selection is a trade-off between the loss of source flux. If you start making this aperture too small, you won't get all the light in the aperture. And I'll show you that it's hard to get all the light in the aperture in any case. But if you try to increase it, then you could start running into contaminating objects. And also, although we haven't started discussing noise, you can appreciate that if you're starting to include a lot of the sky pixels for very little gain in extra light from the object, then you're going to have more noise. In one of the future lectures, we'll actually go through the silver-noise equation. So the trade-off in selecting the size. But you only want to remember this guy because I think to your eye, you'd say you probably have almost all the flux, probably even if that aperture is too large. But we'll see, maybe it's not. All right, so the next thing is usually you want to have some sort of buffer region between your aperture and where you begin to measure the sky. So the sky will include everything in what we'll call a sky aperture. And the reason you want the buffer is because there could be some source flux out here, and you don't want to actually subtract some flux from the source from the flux of the source itself, because then you'll not only lose that, but you'll have subtracted some background from here that you really should not have.
Cool.
So you have some sort of buffer region and then an inner sky annulus.
But we think there still might be some flux of the star in the...
Right between the pink and the yellow. Yeah, that would be the concern, that there could still be object flux in there. And you can see if I started to squeeze down on this guy to try to get fewer and fewer sky pixels, that would definitely be a concern.
So we're not going to use that to calculate the sky?
The area in green would not be calculated.
Okay.
So everything out here is sky for the moment, but usually we don't want to just include the whole rest of the image in this. So we have an inner sky radius, and not surprisingly then, an outer radius. Okay, so I've denoted these R sky 1, R sky 2. And here basically what you're trying to do is get enough sky to get a really good statistical representation so that there's no uncertainty introduced in the mean level. Because remember, this sky basically is an attempt to estimate the sky underlying your object. Now, you will have some types of contaminating objects. Here are our real astronomical sources. Here's a cosmic ray, for example. And you want basically this to look more or less, if you start seeing places where due to fringing or whatever, things are acting up out here, that might also limit how far out you want to put your sky aperture.
How is that? Is that another problem?
Well, we'll get to those. Yes, they are a problem. They have to be dealt with. They must be dealt with in there. So I just mentioned that they're contaminating the sky measurement.
Dealing with a pink arrow.
Yes. So, thank you, Saul, for the audio. Okay, so this all sounds pretty simple. All we had to do is define some circles centered on some source and make some measurements, right? So basically your inner aperture, what you hope is it has all that flux F from your object. And then basically within there, there's also contribution from the sky in proportion to the area of your aperture, so pi r aperture squared. And that is basically what your computer program, whatever, would return to you when you put this aperture down and integrate within it. Likewise, the sky aperture, you'd have the amount of sky in this annulus, right? So between R sky 2 and R sky 1, so you get an estimate S then of what the sky contribution is, or the integrated sky in your sky annulus. So all you're trying to do basically is solve for sky in this, right? You're trying to solve for F, but the sky aperture is then allowing you to eliminate sky from the equation for the number of counts contained in the photometry aperture. Right, so this is just basically the scaling of the areas of the photometry aperture and the sky annulus. And this gives you then the flux of the object. So in the ideal world, we'd be done at this point.
I'm just a little confused on units. Are we counting photons per unit area, or just photons of the object, like summing over all its area?
Well, in this case, this is the sky brightness per pixel. And the radius that I'm quoting here, these are all in pixels. You could choose some other units like arc seconds on the sky, but clearly you have to be consistent, right? Because this has to be per whatever the units, the sky has to be per whatever units are that you're quoting your radius in to get the math right. And working in pixels is just fine. There's no reason. You might have some tangential reasons why eventually your sky estimate, you might want to convert it to a surface brightness. But for this application, you really don't have to worry about it. So working in pixel space is fine.
And most software, you'll see, whenever you see something that says sky, they're usually talking about sky per pixel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of the units of it, these are just going to be whatever your analog to digital units are. With our photometry, we also often multiply by gain so that we think these are basically photoelectrons. But we'll get to that more when we're talking about the signal noise. But otherwise, basically you're measuring this, if you measure all kinds of comparison objects on the same system, you can calibrate them all relative to each other. Okay. All right. So one of the issues that we may have to worry about that I hinted at is that some of the object flux may be outside the photometry aperture. So even though it didn't look like that to the eye, let's take a closer look. All right, so I've chosen this object really to make a point, because sometimes you don't always see this. But this is the radial profile of that object, which is a star. So here's the radius in pixels going from 0 to 15 in this case. And this is a logarithmic scale of the flux. So in the center of the object, I'm up here at about 80,000 counts. And I'm going down here to where I'm down at 100 counts, down to 10 counts out here, and I'm starting to run into the sky. And here's the best fit Gaussian to this. And so for one thing, you can see that it's not really a Gaussian, even though we happily approximate them as Gaussians. There's always extra power in the wings. We'll discuss this more, but there, I just mentioned, first of all, diffraction will cause some of this, also scattering in the atmosphere, and the optics will cause this. So there's always this envelope out here. And so you can see there is still object flux. When I continue this plot further out, it really wasn't out to about here where I was running into the sky. Now let's look at this on a cumulative flux plot to see really how much does this add up to.
The y-axis is the pixel count times gain, right? Because pixel count just
It was just raw counts, analog to digital units on the detector. It was really only the relative shape that you cared about on that plot.
Right, but how do we get the number 80,000?
So there was 10 to the fifth,
right,
was the top of the plot, and it was a logarithmic plot. So all I was saying is that the peak flux on that plot was about 80,000. Right here, here's 100,000.
Right, but all the
here's 10,000.
Aren't the pixels maxed out at 255 or something like that?
No.
Where the number 80,000 actually comes from.
So I have a digital image,
okay,
and I go in and see what the pixel values are, and I plot each pixel value versus its radius here. And on the detector that I'm working on, scaled the way I scaled it.
The pixels aren't capped at 255.
No, absolutely not.
Oh, okay.
And 255 would be, let's see, how many bits? It's
8 bits. Yeah, so these are 16 bits, but even so, I can scale the numbers around.
So in this graph and the next one, this is without any background flux.
This here I've actually subtracted out the background flux from this picture.
So the noise that you have, that's probably still from the background. It seems like
this chatter here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's when we start talking about noise, that's what we're going to see, is that the reason this doesn't behave perfectly. I mean, there can be real structure out there. So for instance, due to diffraction, you'll get diffraction spikes. So you actually, if you took an annulus around a bright star, you actually would see some modulation out here that's real.
Okay.
But most of this is just scatter.
And even an airy function, right, has an extra power that ring at the very end. Or cut off of your mirror of your telescope, you'll see this, you know, pattern has ringing. And then that, since it's radial, you've averaged over all angles. So you know, some of the ringing will be
right. So let's just see, The fact that it's not a Gaussian, we'll come back to in other lectures, because oftentimes we assume things are Gaussian. But let's actually see in this example, for that big aperture that I laid down, it looked like it pretty much had all the flux in. I have here the cumulative flux, that is the amount of flux within radius R. It's normalized to 1 out at my sky aperture. And here's the radius in pixels. So here is where on that picture I had drawn my radius. And so I'm getting all but about 3% of the flux in that aperture. And this is sort of typical of how these things go, right? So this part, ramps up pretty steeply, looks like an error function, which is what you'd get if it were a Gaussian profile. But then a longer wing to get out to all the flux. So the thing to remember basically is you never are measuring all the flux from any object. And what you have to look for is consistency. If you get the same fraction of flux from all of your objects, you can still get all their relative photometry correctly. So you need to pay attention to that, to think, how am I making the measurement? Is it going to give me the same relative flux? In fact, one thing maybe I can mention, going back to this other plot, although we really have not discussed atmospheric seeing, this stuff out here basically is coming from stuff that's not changing a lot with time, like the diffraction pattern of the telescope, scattering in the optics of the telescope, scattering the atmosphere, like the phase function by which aerosols, say, scatter light or Rayleigh scattering. Right, so this is not going to vary a lot, say, from night to night on a given telescope, certainly not from minute to minute. But we have made some passing reference to atmospheric seeing, which blurs the cores of the image. So this part does vary from image to image. And so, in fact, getting the same fractional light can be a little bit tricky, because usually what you're doing is you're measuring a Gaussian full width half max, right? The Gaussian full width half max is going to be measured up here, right? And you're trying to guess at whether, you know, should you be scaling your aperture, right, to account for the fact that this Gaussian component is going to become broader or narrower, or should you be looking at this scattered component out here? And the reason I picked this particular image is that usually you don't see as much of this. This is an image with pretty good seeing. And so you actually see the effects of the telescope in the atmosphere, whereas for lots of our data, this Gaussian will basically get shifted way out here. And then you are in a regime where things scale a little bit more with the full width half max of the Gaussian. So it's the kind of thing you have to look at. So when I was first doing the photometry on this, I was just scaling by the full width half max of the Gaussian. I was noticing some problems, and this is why. So just, you know, bear that in mind, that you always have this aperture correction, and you want it to be a known number across all of your images. So
you might mention that sometimes when people are trying to use really bright standard stars, they will use a huge aperture. If they have a lot of signals, they don't worry about the noise you bring in with the aperture. So intentionally, they can get out to this region where you have most of the light included, and that's more stable with respect to the thing.
Right, but then you have to be careful, because if you're not measuring your objects that same way, then you may be getting all the light from your standard star, not all the light from your objects. If you know how to make the correction, so I really didn't go into this further with the aperture correction, but you might have brighter stars in the field that tell you what your correction is for that particular image. And that allows you to get around this thing of where your standards might have been measured in a very large aperture, and you need to measure in a smaller aperture to do photometry of some faint object, but then you may use an intermediate brightness star that's on your CCD frame, which would have the same point spread function, same profile like this, to figure out what's the correction between the two. So there's a little bookkeeping involved there. Okay, so the other thing that's already been mentioned is that this that sky annulus already contains contaminating objects. So let's actually look at the sky here. Someday I'll finish my lecture more than 5 minutes before the start, and then I'll actually put these together. But not yet. All right, so, well, I should have probably done this in two steps. So anyway, the black curve here is the histogram of the pixels in the sky annulus. Now, I've actually taken a larger sample so we could get a nice look at the shape here. So these are pixel values, and this is, again, logarithmically the number. So what we might expect is it'll just be a Gaussian distribution of values. And if it were Gaussian distribution of values, it would follow this dashed cyan curve here, right? In log space, Gaussian is going to be a parabola. So you can see that there are deviations from that. One curious little thing that surprised me when I first made the plot, but I understood it, is this little Prussian helmet spike here. And I remember last time we talked about how we make these sky flaps, and that the image that you're trying to do science off of might have been included in the construction of the sky flap. So some fraction of the pixels might have been the ones that made it into the sky flap. And when that happens, then you basically don't have a noise component due to that, because you're ratioing them against each other. So you get a little excess. This is the fractional excess. So basically, you could figure out how many of the pixels from the science image, from which I made this histogram, how many pixels are actually the pixel values that ended up in the sky flap from doing this. And it's probably because I would have taken a median, and a median, right, the actual value of a pixel in the science frame can be, you know, perfectly replicated into the sky flap, because the median is choosing which of the values to use. Now another thing you see is this. Okay, so what is this? Well, basically it's all the faint sources in the field. And roughly speaking, you can sort of work in a Euclidean universe, or even in an accelerating universe, as we have. There's basically a power law distribution, roughly, of sources, right? As you go fainter, the objects are fainter hard to detect, but you gain more volume. You gain volume more quickly than you lose objects due to their faintness. And so you, since you have both the brightness scaling of the power law of the distance and the volume scaling of the power law of the distance, for a universe filled homogeneously with sources, you're going to need a power law distribution of sources. So you can see that what we're really seeing in the sky is the superposition of just the Gaussian noise due to the mean sky value, and then this set of power law sources. And here you can actually run into a little controversy. So the question is, okay, I have a couple of different ways I could estimate the sky value, right? I could get the mean, the median, or the mode, and this relative location of all these is basically typical of any positively skewed distribution, right? The mean is going to be out here, the median is going to be in between, and the mode is going to be the smallest of the three numbers that you pick. Now, these actually happen to be pretty close together. But there's a question, what is the value for the sky? If I take the mean, then I am including sources. And now here I've averaged over the whole image, but you can see in the example I showed you before that there are probably three or four faint little objects in there, right? And probably if you cut them out specifically, then this whole tail would vanish. That is, they are a subpopulation from this tail of brighter sources. So then you get something where probably just using a mean, but where you have rejected specifically the objects that you can see, would be some sort of reasonable estimate.
Because you're going to reject the, in the final reference, for the supernova case at least, you're going to reject the thing.
So you're stealing my punchline.
I'm sorry. You're getting ahead.
Yeah, I have to take this in order, please.
I take it back.
I have to edit that. That'll be 7 minutes. right, so a common thing is to take something that seems relatively robust, like the mode. There is an argument sometimes raised that underneath your object, right, where you've laid down your aperture, maybe there's this population of faint objects as well. Maybe you just don't see them, right? They're there statistically. So if I were measuring the brightnesses of a large ensemble of objects, I may oftentimes get faint little sources in there that have nothing to do with the object I want to photometer. Right? So one could make the argument that really, if I wanted to get the right photometry for a large ensemble of objects, I don't want to take the mode or even the median, because I will always get a lower sky, and therefore all my objects will end up too bright in the mean. So you have to think about this a little bit depending on what the photometry is that you're trying to do. One of the things is it's always wise to have something that's robust, because not only can you have these objects, but cosmic rays, of course, can just enter in there and be spurious, which is why people often prefer using medians and modes, because it takes care of those quite nicely. And one last little gripe, I think partly prompted because Max was talking about the inscrutable Ivan code. And there are some things that are inscrutable in doing aperture photometry that might surprise you. But one being that you're taking an integral within a circle or within an annulus, right, on a square grid. And so you have to do interpolation or extrapolation, figure out how to properly count all these pixels at the periphery. And now in this example that I'm showing, well, that looks pretty easy, right? Linear interpolation across that is going to be just fine. But if I had a much smaller aperture in here, you can see, for instance, if I said, well, I'm actually going to try to measure about 80% of the flux of the object, because that's best in terms of solenoid, I could be trying to interpolate across this rather steep profile of the object, right? And when you go and look at algorithms, some of them are pretty sloppy about doing this. And if you're not sloppy, they can be time-consuming. So oftentimes people intentionally skip it for speed. So if you go into a lot of code that's made for, say, doing photometry of galaxies, you'll find they completely ignore these kinds of subtleties. And so you can, you know, that photometry is inherently going to have some sorts of problems. This also becomes a problem. I gave the example of decreasing the size of the aperture, but you could also imagine that instead of this object being spread over many pixels as it is, that it could be spread over 3 or 4 pixels. So what does it mean to take an aperture, say, with a 2-pixel radius, and my object is spread over 3 of those? The gradients are extremely sharp now. So you have to think about whether you're really getting an honest measurement of the objects in this case.
Why do you have to have a...
So that's the other thing, is you can define an aperture. Now, one of the things you have to remember is you have to define it consistently, perhaps across many images. So where I might pick a very nice pattern here that is perfectly aligned with my object, with the grid on which object A was observed, when I try to take that aperture and measure this on object B, maybe it's shifted, and I'm still doing interpolation. So I still have to think about that. So you can't just, you know, it depends, again, on the accuracy, the kind of data that you have, as to whether you have to worry about this kind of thing or not. Yeah.
Are there algorithms for doing all this?
Well, so you could do something like that, but, and out here, you can see that wouldn't be an issue. Yeah. Right? So that's what a lot of the galaxy codes do. Is they'll say, these pixels are, you know, within radius R, the centers of those pixels are within radius R, I'll just count those up. Right, and that's what a fast and sloppy algorithm would be. The problem, again, becomes that your object, the different times that you observe it, it might not always be aligned the same way. So the center, in one case, could be in the middle of a pixel, and the other time it's the center is actually right between 2 pixels. And so you have an aperture that's moving around. So it'd be like me taking this circle and saying, well, in this object I'll measure it in this circle, but another object I'll measure it in this circle over here. Right? Again, sometimes you can get away with that. It really depends on the precision that you're going for.
How can you just calculate the centroid?
Run that by me again?
I mean, you can just calculate your centroid again, right?
Yeah.
And just see where your new center is, and then just go and
come. Yeah, so you would.
Right?
Yeah. You'd always track your object. That would be the default way to do it. But now if I have an aperture that has to be aligned to the grid on my pixels, or the grid of pixels on my detector, right, then I get a misalignment. Yeah. Okay, so Saul and stealing my punchline is the fact that in certain ways, pseudophotometry makes this a little bit easier. if we get final reference images, we can cancel out some of these systematics problems, especially the contamination of objects in the background. So I'm just going to run through this aspect of it really quickly then. So here's one of our supernova. What is this one? This is NB235, sitting on the edge of a barely observable spiral galaxy in this LIC 1 meter image. And here's a reference image taken about a year later at the CTIO 1.5 meter. Okay, and although you really don't see much galaxy contamination in this LIC image, you worry, you can see the little arm just sort of sticking out here. So you worry it's there. The question is, can you accurately subtract it? So what do we go and do with the supernova photometry? Okay, first of all, we have to have some way to figure out how to transfer this supernova aperture over here. That is, where it is that we're supposed to measure on this other image. Right? So we basically pick a number of stars. We have a program, ISOFINE, that goes and does this. Finds objects on both images and then matches them up. And what this would do is give you shifts, rotations, scale differences between the two images. I should have picked I thought because I was picking off of two different telescopes, the scales would be dramatically different, but they really aren't here. Turns out that they're, within 10% or something. So it wasn't as obvious an example as it might otherwise be, but you can imagine very different scales, rotations. Of course, our code is generally very good at finding those, although I should comment that the number of objects that are available here in this LIC image is rather small compared to what our algorithm likes. It really performs well on the high redshift fields where we have thousands of astrometric reference objects. So that tells us how to align them spatially. Okay, the other thing that we have to do is scale them in brightness. And so we may use these same objects I've shown before. In this case, on the earlier slide, I'd used this one to help align, but I didn't use it as a fiducial to tell me what should be the relative scaling and brightnesses between the two frames. Now, I could say, well, what I will do is I will independently calibrate these two frames. And, then whatever my calibration says is the scaling between them, I'll employ that. But we generally find that we can do much better with this relative scaling between any two frames than we can ever do in terms of the absolute scaling. Moreover, this allows us to use frames where there's no photometric calibration. That might occur because it was Cirrus-y out or something like that. Right? So there might have been Cirrus clouds.
Oh, Cirrus-y.
Yeah. So maybe not possible to have, there wouldn't have been a point to take off standard stars and calibrate this. So we do this differentially. And the extent that the responses of these two detectors with their filters is similar, we can do this with very high precision. So it's something called differential photometry. Basically, we're doing scaling between images to look at the relative brightnesses. So that's the next step, is picking these fiducials. And maybe just in case anyone scrutinizes these later, I'll comment. I had to pick this object down here to include, but when I looked at it more closely, there are actually two objects there. And so that probably would also be a poor choice, either for astrometric alignment between the two objects or for fiducials. It'll be really hard with two very closely spaced objects to get the positions or the fluxes measured in a reliable way.
Your reference stars, is there
them, well, so for the astrometry references, you really don't pay too much attention, because what happens is ISOFINE would find them, it would match the ones it can, right? And then, since the majority should be pretty good matches, usually you don't have to play around. Now, if you do have a few objects, your transformation between images could be susceptible to problems due to this object, for example, in which case you'd have to try to eliminate that. Likewise for the fiducials, I mean, one of the things that you're trying to do is to see how things scale in brightness. And so you want to look for things that are not behaving as the other objects do. Sometimes there are good reasons. You can see cosmic rays scattered around here that have not been cleaned out. Actually, this is a little worrisome here, the bad column right where the supernova should be. Things like that they have to keep an eye out for. And although, so we haven't started discussing noise, but noise also will affect things. So you could get, you know, four or five stars that seem to agree and a fifth one doesn't quite agree. Is that just due to noise or not? And does it have a big effect on the relative scaling that you get? And so sometimes that requires judgment, usually only when you have so few objects that you can't employ really robust techniques and you have to start looking at things individually.
Not to match, is foggy good?
Well, for spatial matching, right? We generally are doing a translation, a scale, and a rotation. So, in its general form, if you allow shear between the x and y axes, then you've got six parameters, right? So you need at least six stars to do this properly, and so you'd like double that. If you have double that, you start feeling reasonably comfortable. Now, the other thing is their spatial location relative to the supernova, right? If they were all down in this corner, right, then I'm extrapolating my solution, right? And that's fairly unreliable because, in fact, if it's anything but a linear solution, your terms are going to be unconstrained out here and just go wild. Even if it's a linear solution, it might not be adequate, although what might happen is if you have no choice, you might be forced to linear solution, hoping that you can extrapolate from the stars over here just a little bit extra out to your supernova. Yeah.
Do you have to worry about in a case like this where they're already pretty similar scale and stuff?
Generally, it doesn't actually help you because you can almost always get the things within several percent, either in terms of spatially matching or flux matching. Right. Right? So the fact that they started out similar, It probably only helps for the automated matching routine, or would help you if you had to go through and figure out the matching, right? Because you're not having to do gymnastics with your eye of, you know, rotating and flipping and all kinds of things like that. But in terms of, you know, the accuracy, it generally isn't going to help. If they're the exact same detector, and the supernova is in a similar location, or, you know, its reference location is similar, then you could imagine that now if there are some higher order terms in the mapping, that actually those would start to come close to canceling out. Right? So there obviously can be some benefit there if it's actually the same telescope. But here with different telescopes, in fact, I'm pretty sure this one has a much stronger astrometric correction than that telescope has there. So, yeah, there are lots of different cases. But certainly, it always helps if you've got things on the same telescope, because also then you know your detector and filter combination are basically the same. And so, in terms of the fiducial matching, usually you'll see much better agreement in those. Why would there be shear? Well, there really shouldn't be, right? You could imagine some things, which I'm kind of making up. For instance, someone actually has to lay pixels down a piece of silicon. So they have to make a mask, a photolithography mask, whatever, to do that. There's no guarantee that that was done, you know, without any sort of shear. So I'd say that might be the biggest thing. Optically, you can get some localized shear due to things like pincushion distortion, right? So it's not always a purely radial distortion introduced by telescope. So those would be reasons why you might have that.
When you said scaling, you also meant spatial scaling, right? Not just the brightness?
Yeah, so let's see, maybe I didn't. So this is, yeah, it was all encoded in this word aligned.
Okay.
Is that it's the full transformation spatially, right?
When you're
so yeah, I should have added spatially aligned. Yeah.
When you're correcting for the spatial scaling, it doesn't mess with your.
Well, so here one of the tricks that although when we subtract images, look for supernova, we actually have to resample them. In this case, all we really care about is figuring out how to translate this aperture over to here, right? And so it's a shift, and actually rotation doesn't matter, and then there's a slight scaling. Okay. And so then I would just go ahead and perform the aperture photometry here. So this would basically be my sky aperture, and this would be my photometry aperture that I'm subtracting to. So yeah, that's one of the things that's a little clever about this, that we don't ever resample the data in doing this calculation. We do have to do that when we subtract them, but that's when you're subtracting the whole image, you don't know where the objects are. And the brightness scaling, in terms of the statistics, then you can keep track of that in the propagation of errors. All right, so I already mentioned this verbally, but the apertures now are aligned. So in principle, the contamination subtracts out. Now, the thing that I'm not going to have time to get to today, the last little bit here, which is really a subject unto its own, if I can find it, is the thing that I've ignored so far in this discussion is scaling due to point spread function differences, right? Because now I'm a little bit torn. I have a little schizophrenia here. That is, I don't care too much about aperture sizes at all when I'm doing the astrometry. I just need to make sure I'm getting good positions.
When you say astrometry?
So astrometry, moving. This is the spatial alignment.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. But when I'm doing the fiducials, right, I do need to make sure I'm measuring the same fraction of light on both sets of images. So there, I need to do some scaling based on the relative point spread functions. But now here, I'm actually trying to subtract out a discrete background. So what do? I can't make my aperture bigger because I'll include other parts of the galaxy, maybe that were not included when I was measuring the supernova. So there, what I do have to do is look at the relative point spread function between this image and this image. And before I make this sky measurement, I have to make a convolution in order to make sure that, for instance, if the seeing were very bad, maybe more light from this galaxy makes it into this aperture here. So it's one thing I have to account for. And point spread function scaling and all the intricacies of point spread functions are one of our bread and butter items that I really am going to need to spend some more time on. But that's sort of the last little thing here is you have to maintain that logical consistency depending on which step you're doing. Okay, so I think that's all that I had for today. And next week we'll talk about how one actually calibrates this, because now we've taken it through the steps basically where we have measured the photometry of an object, we've measured the sky, we subtract them, we get some sort of flux. The question is, where do we go from there? So we'll discuss that in the next lecture. Now we can, for those of you in the working group, can transition. I don't know if anyone's had any new questions since Friday or not.
Fred, I have a random question.
Yeah.
There's other programs out there finding sources for star types.
Hmm?
So how does that compare with, say,
iGridFinder? Well, for finding things, they're all using a very similar algorithm. So there's something sort of written up in the 70s that's used, the same idea is used, but basically you're going along with a threshold. You say, this pixel is above a threshold, I'll keep it in a buffer. And I'll basically keep track of how long it's above the threshold. So I keep what's called a bit of a run length. So I have one object and I'll have a little segment for it. If I come along the next column of the CCD, I might detect that object again. And that's just a matter of trying to put things together based on rules. And there's a pretty efficient algorithm for doing it. And variants of that are used in most of these codes. So I think IsoFind and Extractor are probably using very similar things. And they're very fast at finding objects.
Performance-wise, they're kind of...
I haven't noticed big differences. I mean, my use of some of these different algorithms, I've shifted from one to the other, and so computers have gotten faster. I mean, it used to be that, yeah, time actually did matter once upon a time, but now I think they're all roughly equally fast. There will be differences in how they do photometry, which if you, even one package like Extractor, if you've looked at that, right, there are lots of different kinds of fluxes you can get out of there.
One clever trick that you might mention that they use for discovery is this one that if you convolve first with a Gaussian that's roughly the same width as the scene of that image, that turns out to be close to an optimal signal-to-noise threshold for cut-on. And you can, turns out that if you, I remember that sort of clever paper with it by, where he pointed out that if you do that convolution, the peak of that convolution turns out to be exactly equal to the best bit least square of that point spread function, to the height of that the peak, which is kind of cute, but it also is convenient because lots of people have algorithms for just convolving with a Gaussian. So you'll see, for example, I think in our FindStar program, they often get run first before it's defined, or sometimes they're even run after. You'll see that that's what's in there if you look closely at the algorithm.
Yeah, the radio people do this all the time, so you actually, when they make these maps, instead of actually photometering something, you just go and measure the peak value, because that peak value now is equal to the total flux of the object.
All these programs that we have written, you know, yeah, like IsoFind, stuff like that, they're recipes off that use algorithms in the 70s, I mean...
Well, it's not I know numerical recipes doesn't have this object finding.
I didn't mean like
I just meant like. Well, IsoFind actually was an algorithm, I think specifically that Ivan Small developed after trying to iterate from other ideas of how you do ISO that he saw.
I didn't really like the camera, I feel like, for a lot of the.
Yeah. No, because he got some of his ideas from our previous generation that we had done. So it was already going through. But
well, so what did you first use? So does Ivan's thing, does IsoFind not do run-length coding? I mean, how does it do the final object detection? Is it just set a threshold?
It's been such a long time. I believe that he first finds objects, and then he works down, he dilates them, and works down from them, and then tries to find where you hit a, and then he has various different thresholds that you can set for what counts as still being above noise, that he then blocks together into a single object. Yeah. But he ended up, first he came up with this algorithm, and then he went back and came up with a clever computer algorithm that would do it relatively quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a couple iterations on it at the time to make that one work.
Yeah, there's the one threshold for finding a pixel.
Right.
And that's higher, and then finding all the pixels that are
connected.
That's right.
Which is less stringent. You know, that was more in as long as they're connected.
So that is a little bit different than the run-length coding idea, which is basically you have one low threshold and then you're trying to piece things together after the fact. It sounds like he looks for peaks and then finds the rest of the mountain below it, basically.
Right. Yeah. So I think it used as a starting point the FindStar, which is the one I was just describing where you first convolve and then you look for peaks in the convolved image. And that program that we stole from DAO folks, which was an earlier, which is still actually a package people use for stellar photometry. So this sort of mix of all these different.
Yeah, for the most part, those algorithms now are fairly robust, but there are ways when you start getting to the photometry part where people cheat a little bit, depending, basically if they want speed, right, then they'll make some little cheats, which for a lot of things. But in fact, one of the comments, I don't think I was going to mention it this lecture, maybe when we have the calibration, but I'll mention it since I started here, is that really the supernova photometry is one of the only areas where you're trying to do precise photometry of really faint objects. Most other faint object work deals with galaxies for the most part, and people, they don't know what to make if they know the galaxy brightness to 1%. It doesn't mean anything special compared to it having been 1% brighter or fainter, right? Because the galaxies have a whole range of colors and brightnesses, and so you're just looking at large statistical properties. So you never worry about doing precision photometry for galaxies.
What about lensing?
Lensing to get ratios of lenses Yeah. So that can matter. But most other kind of work that's done on large telescopes is not trying to do this precision work. So we probably work much closer into the sky than a lot of other programs. So a lot of these little subtleties, you at least want to know, are they affecting you very much? So for instance, your error in the estimate of the sky, if the object is running across the sky, you can be very sloppy about estimating the sky accurately. But if your object swamped by the sky, then you could be completely dominated by the uncertainty in how well you measure the sky brightness.
All right, so we've ended up with codes where, since we weren't really sure we trusted what we ended up with for the sky, we would intentionally take random sampling of apertures that were the same size as the aperture you're using for photometry, and just throw them all around and see what sky would you have gotten if you had used that algorithm and what that distribution looks like. So there are often these sort of extra checks that we did that most people don't need to do.
Greg, will you be co-adding images when we
I don't have it on there yet. Might be something I can have Alex talk about. We've talked about some
that step comes in.
Yeah, so for instance, last week I mentioned that you're doing, well, I haven't actually discussed how this you want to actually preserve the object. Technically, we only really do that during insertion. With photometry, we've always stuck to making independent measurements off of all it's hard to combine things in a way that doesn't mess with the noise. On the other hand, if you have lots of images of an object, then you get a good error estimate from all of those examples. So I think the only case that you might combine images is if somehow the images were of a nature that other were related.
Right.
But for searching, yeah, if we get around to talking on searching, that would be a big deal. Okay, so I guess we had a pretty good discussion on Friday. I don't know if anyone has been over the weekend.